That sounds good. I hate to interrupt him. After Ernie last night and Francis this morning, I've got my work cut out for me. When I saw you people coming up and hugging and kissing her, and you were crying and she was crying also, I just had to shed a few tears. Jim and others who contacted us approximately a year ago to join you in this wonderful meeting here, I've enjoyed it tremendously up until now. When he contacted us, that's a year in advance. You know, that's what you call living this program, a year at a time. Anyhow, since I saw somebody else take their watch off up here, it looked impressive, so I'm going to do mine the same way. One of the last things I like to do before I come to a meeting like this is to call on somebody that I know who is good and drunk, or an Al-Anon who is still loaded with self-pity and resentment and hatred. And I didn't have to do it this time because, you see, I asked God to send us somebody to help. And you better not pray for anything unless you don't really want it. Because Francis brought an alcoholic woman home. She spent 2 weeks with us. And about a week ago, some people had a drug addict that they didn't know what to do with, and it was in San Angelo, and they brought her up there and turned her over to Francis. She came in one of these zombie types, you know. This kind of keeps me centered in the middle of the road, so I won't get the idea associating with you people that the war on alcoholism is over and everybody is safe and sane and sober and well on the road to spiritual, emotional, and possibly financial maturity. I feel somewhat like a little boy who, at one time, he never had spoken a word. His parents, he's about 8 years old. His parents were quite concerned about this child. And they'd had him to specialists all over the country. And there wasn't anything organically wrong with him. He just never had said anything. And one morning, he came down to breakfast, and his mother was busy clearing away some of the dishes, those that had finished, and his father was getting ready to go to the office, and he sat down to his oatmeal and started stirring it, and finally he said, "This oatmeal is lumpy as hell." Well, his mother was, first words he'd uttered, she was in a state of shock, she dropped the dishes, and his father whirled around, and they both stood there kind of in a trance. And finally they said, "Son, what made you talk? What made you utter your first word?" And he said, "Well, everything's been all right up until now." Well, everything's been all right in this program up until this meeting. As we're given the format, the outline of what a talk is to be like, read from the 5th chapter, our story is disclosed in a general way, what we used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. Every time I get up here, there's also a temptation to speak beyond my experience. But this is never effective because that which does not come from the heart does not seem to reach the heart. I am Buck Newsom. I am the husband, the brother, the brother-in-law, the son, the grandson, I'm not through yet, and the father of alcoholics. I did not get here by mistake. I am a member of the 710 Al-Anon group in Midland, Texas. Marceline White, who many of you know, and to know Marceline is to love her, is my sponsor. In a very real sense, God, as I understand him, is my sponsor. The real reason I'm here is in the 12th step. It says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps we tried to carry, this message to alcoholics and others, and practice these principles in all of our affairs. It also tells me in the big book that my real purpose is to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and to those about me. Now, as I stand here, my thoughts can literally fly. But unfortunately, I have to encode these thoughts into sounds. And you, upon receiving these sounds, decode. And if you don't have the same thought impulse on decoding that I had on encoding, then we're no longer communicating. A great man put this in far better words than I can when he said, our thoughts may be likened unto a bird of space, which in a cage of words may spread their wings, but they can never fly. And this is so true. So inasmuch as we're all prisoners within the confines of the dictionary, it's very important that I attempt to choose the correct words up here in order to communicate with you. Now, communication has been defined as the art of transmitting thoughts, feelings, or ideas by writing, talking, or acting in such a manner that understanding results. Perhaps a little story will help illustrate the misuse of words. I like to tell this. A peasant in the old country found himself guilty of having spread malicious gossip about a friend, only to find out later on that these words were untrue. Wishing to make amends for what he had done, he went to the priest and confessed. And the priest was old and wise. He said, you must take a bag of goose feathers and go throughout the village, dropping one feather in front of each doorway. Now, eagerly he complied, and returning announced that his task was done. But the old priest said, not yet, my son. Now you must go back and pick up each feather. But the wind will have blown them all away, he said. So it is with words. Once dropped, it's next to impossible to get them back. Our story can be summed up in a few short words. AA and Al-Anon and Alateen opened the gates of hell for the Newsoms and let us out. For this, I'm very grateful. But I didn't fly some 1,500 miles zigzag across the country to get here to talk for about 5 minutes and sit down. So settle back and get comfortable. There's more coming. Anyway, this program for me can be likened not into a restaurant where I can place my orders and things are brought to me. It's more like a cafeteria. I have to help myself. And herein is a basic principle of Mother Nature. That is, output varies directly proportional to input. I can't get anything out of it unless I put something into it. I used to say when I'd get up here that I was scared. I'm not scared anymore because one of the promises that comes after the ninth step has been realized recently in my life. That is, fear of people will leave us. I used to be scared when I'd get up here. I'm not scared anymore. I'm nervous, and there's a difference. And the reason I was scared, I found out why I was scared in my fourth step. I was fearful of the possibility that I might say something up here that would give you people I'm not as good as I think I am. If I was twice as good as I tried to be, I still wouldn't be half as good as I think I am. But this is a manifestation of the ego. Since this is one of the first things that they told me when I came into Al-Anon, incident, I came in and there was about 30 women there and one man sitting in the back, and I sat down, and after the program was over, this guy walked up to me and says, my name's Blackie Ligon, not sure I'm glad to see you here. I thought I was the only SOB in Midland had a drunk wife. But we have 11 men there now in our Al-Anon group, besides the women. They told me that when I came in that I was to let go and let God. Now, I didn't know what this meant. because I'd let go of Frances to die and she didn't die, and I resented the hell out of her. This is the way it was. This is the way it was. Let go and let God, that means get off her back, translated in words that I could understand. Let go and let God. You know, when I let go and let God, he did a tremendous job. And I'm proud of this gal. And you saw why this morning. What do I mean by let go? I heard this little story. I read it once. And it helps to illustrate. I read how they capture little monkeys in the jungle. Those are to be kept as pets. They take Naranek bottles and wire them into the trees. And in the bottom of each bottle, they place a small red rubber ball. And the little monkey, overcome by curiosity, he reaches his paw into the bottle and grasps the ball, only to find out that he can't get free. He's a prisoner by virtue of his clenched fist, when in reality he could be free if he had just let go. Let go and let God. Before AA and Al-Anon, my father was a medical doctor. He graduated from Galveston Medical College in 1897. He was alive today. He would be 108 years old. He died in 1942. He didn't marry until he was 42. I have a sister that's 9 years older than I am. I'm glad to be here. I was wondering if he's going to get that. Anyway, he and my mother divorced when I was just a kid, and my mother remarried to a West Texas rancher, and I was raised on a ranch in West Texas. I'm sure you couldn't gather that by the way I talk. I'm a misplaced cowboy. But inasmuch as I couldn't get along with my stepfather, I decided I'd go to college. So I went to Texas Tech. And there, I moved next door to, fell in love with, and married the speaker you heard this morning. We were married in 1942. This was long about the time World War II was coming around, and I'd had several deferments. The draft was nipping at me pretty close, so I volunteered into aviation cadets and was commissioned a pilot. I went overseas with the 8th Air Force. I was stationed in England. I flew 27 and a half missions over Germany. I didn't come back from my 28th one right then. I was shot down over Leipzig. I was a prisoner of war for approximately a year. Now, looking back on this, I took my fourth step in combat, but not being aware of it in its present identity, but since I saw a lot of my buddies get it, I wanted to try to set the book straight, since the odds were pretty good that I'd be cashing in my chips before this was all over. When I was shot down, I was the third oldest pilot in the group that I was in. This will give you an idea of the turnover. Anyway, I want to try to tell you what the difference is for me between a spiritual experience and a spiritual awakening. You know, in the 12th step, it used to say spiritual experience, but this has been reworded to spiritual awakening. And this is just for me, because a spiritual experience that happened to me in combat that I'm going to try to share with you. How many times does it say this in the Bible? It says it came to pass. Well, this means that it happened, but it also means something else. It's in the past. I can recall this, but I cannot relive it. And words are so inadequate, but I'm going to try to paint a verbal picture here for you of what happened during this spiritual experience on my third mission over Germany. I flew 16 missions as co-pilot. I flew 12 missions as first pilot. I was flying as co-pilot at this particular time, and we were flying in number two position. This would be the lead ship. We were flying here. Another ship would have been flying over here. We were on the bomb run. And combat can be best described for me as hours of boredom and hard work interrupted by moments of stark, total terror. We were on the bomb run. The lead ship received a direct hit. and it blew up. Now, the altitude at which we were flying in those days, 30,000 feet, was pretty high then. The temperature was 20 to 30 below zero. Their cockpit was not adequately heated. The concussion from this explosion and the ball of flame and the intense heat all just happening just like that. The portions of the debris from this ship that was hit cartwheeled in on top of the ship next to us, and it in turn exploded, and this happened just like that. There was 20 men gone. I was launched to the brink of total terror. Now, I believe if what I'm going to try to tell you hadn't happened, I might possibly have died of heart failure, because this is how strong it was. My heart was in my throat. Total terror. You have to experience this. It's impossible to describe. Then this is the miracle. This is this experience. I was tuned in. I can still get goosebumps telling about it. I was tuned in on the most beautiful music I have ever heard. I'd never heard it before. I have never heard it since. And at first I thought it was coming from the radio. But I took my earphones off, and it seemed as if my whole being was a giant receiver tube listening to this music. And the results of this music is the miracle. Because I was transformed from total terror to the other end of the spectrum just in a few moments, to one at complete peace with my Maker, facing death. And as far as I'm concerned, this is the ultimate of serenity. Now, this lasted for several moments, and then the music faded off into the background. I flew many more missions after that. I would love to have heard this music again. I knew it was there. But see, this was my well. I had heard it once. This was a spiritual experience. It came to pass. The spiritual awakening is the result of these steps. In the 12th step has come to stay. So far. So for me, this is the difference between a spiritual experience and a spiritual awakening. I am sure that many of you have read and possibly heard statements to the effect that God is dead. I can assure you, if God is dead, He died since my third mission. I have a friend in Abilene. He happens to be a minister. He goes to AA meetings. He's a great man. He first went to AA about 18 years ago in Alaska because he thought you people needed help. And he found himself getting help until he comes to AA meetings now. To heck with you, mister. My cup is empty. Would you please notice the empty cup, and would you please share it with me? He said one day a guy came into his office to tell him, said, I came here to tell you that I don't believe in God. And John said, well, what else is new? And he had to tell him about it, and he says, yeah, but I know that makes you mad. And he says, okay, boy, go on. Get on top of the highest hill and shout and scream at the top of your voice, there is no God. There is no God. And you won't hear anything coming back but the hollow echoes of your own voice brought by an aimless, drifting, wandering wind. And God won't climb down off His throne and abdicate just because you don't believe in Him. And you can't sit on it because your butt's not big enough. They're talking pretty straight to one another. He says, if you want to find God, don't shout and scream at the top of your voice. Go get yourself a small closet and crawl in it and close the door and whisper softly, Our Father, and you'll feel Him. I returned to the States after prison camp in 1945. I went to work for the Gulf Oil Corporation as a geologist. I am a rock nut by profession. Francis told you about what other kind of a nut I was this morning. I'm not a normal nut because the world's full of those normal nuts out there, and they don't have this program, and you know they're dangerous. But, as she told you, for a while we engaged in social drinking, and we had a lot of fun. But the trouble with trouble is it seems like it always starts out like fun. All of my life I've been affected by my reactions to the dis-ease of alcoholism. I can now be at ease around my wife if I'm across the room or across the nation. Distance doesn't have anything to do with it. 1968, you know, people before AA, they thought the relationship we had was kind of strange. I mean, the civilians. And they still think it is. Because 1968, Francis went to Bill Wilson's birthday party in New York with three men from Midland there. And I took off to Lake Whitney to a conference similar to this with a divorcee. It's great, this program. The trouble. I heard many Al-Anon say they felt they withdrew within to a shell. I think of myself more in terms of callousness around my heart. You know, if you're working in the yard or your garden or doing some sort of work that involves the use of your hands, the first manifestation of hurt on this tender place is a blister. Now, nature will attempt to protect you if this work is to continue, if this friction continues, because the first layer of callousness will go over that, and then another layer, and another layer, and another layer. And eventually, the hurt is still there, but you're protected by this callous, and it doesn't hurt anymore. This layer of callousness that had been placed around my heart, 9 years ago, I wouldn't have given you the time of day. I'd have stepped right over you and gone right on. My God, if your own family would do this to you, imagine what you strangers out there would do. You let them get close, so I held you all out there at arm's length. I experienced the first time in 1963 at our Brownwood conference. I didn't know what it was at that time, but it was genuine. It was coming from inside. I know now that it was love, an overwhelming concern for the love of my fellow man. This was something real. This was the beginning of the melting of this callousness around my heart. As Francis told you this morning, we went the hospital route. I would like to express an opinion at this point. I do not think it can ever be accomplished chemically or with a scalpel, that which has to be done spiritually. In 1956, we were living in Roswell, New Mexico at the time. I ran myself down trying to take care of a job, two small boys, a sick wife, and I became easy prey for the first bug that came along. And this particular bug happened to be bulbar polio. Now, I don't have any trouble with the second step where it says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, because you see, while I was in the hospital flat on my back with bulbar polio, my wife took drunk and joined me. And I can assure you, if I could have gotten to her, I'd have killed her. It's a good thing I was paralyzed. Anyway, mild insanity, I'm not well. I still am guilty. I spend some time spending money I don't have to buy things I don't need to impress people I don't like. This is sanity. Francis told you about walking up that morning or that afternoon when I came in from work and slapping me. Now, for me, total loss of my temper is total insanity. And this involves with me, not necessarily with everyone, but with me, it's a blackout. I don't know what I'm doing. When I came to myself, this gal was on the floor and I was a straddle of her and I had my hands around her throat and I was choking her to death. So I don't have any trouble the second step. In a few more moments, I would have killed this woman. I would have taken a human life. And this terrified me when I realized what had happened. So, not too long after that, I sued Frances for a divorce, which she told you about also. And I believe in looking back on it, it wasn't anything other than if I was going to survive, I apparently had to get out. Now, I'm grateful that she conned me out of it for many reasons, one of which is she's here and she's sober and she's doing a great job, I think, and I still love her. I like what Gert Bahana says about this. It seemed as though she were Siamese twins, one of which must die that the other might live. And this is the one that lived. This is the woman I married. Some other reasons I'm grateful. You see, if she hadn't been successful in conning me out of this, later on I was to meet my own sister down the road in alcoholism. I would have turned my back on her. And as late as October 1968, my own son, and I would have turned my back on him. So I'm very grateful. I almost missed this program. And by this time, Francis could no longer drink with impunity or anybody else. When she told you this morning, like what Dr. Will Miller said, when she put down the jug and picked up the pill, she turned loose with a pussycat and grabbed a tiger by the tail, and this has been our experience. We moved from Roswell in Fort Worth in 1957 into Midland in 1959. Now, after AA and Al-Anon in 1962, I'd like to say that we came here because we realized that we needed this wonderful program on an all-time basis. That isn't right. We came here running from the alternative. We didn't know what the hell it was. It was bound to be worse than what we had. And it's a good thing we don't have to come here for good motive. Is that right? I think of myself kind of like a starving man. Suppose this man is suffering from malnutrition, and you invite him into your home, and set him down to your table, and he refuses to eat until he understands all the complex processes of digestion, such as calorification, systemic absorption, so forth and so on. What'd you think of somebody like this? You'd probably think he's crazy. And you'd be right. So sensitive is a human being's soul that only a breath of love can call it to conscious existence. An AA, an Al-Anon, an Alateen is the bread of life for the alcoholic and his family. Love is the one thing that God reserved to conquer rebel man, because reason he parries, fear he answers blow for blow, and future interest he'll meet with present plague. But love is the one thing against which the hardest heart will eventually melt. This is not theory, this is my experience. I have found out through Al-Anon that life is a gift, not a sentence. And I've also found out recently, relatively recently, there's not too much difference between everything going my way or everything coming at me. Primarily, the difference is the direction in which my attitude is facing. And I heard a man say this, and it fits me to a T. I think most of my life I've been suffering from a malady called spiritual constipation. Translated, this means too much self unpassed. Anyway, I took steps in 1962 to commit Francis to the Big Spring State Hospital for alcoholism and drug addiction. She told you about some of that this morning. I want to try to tell you something about what the steps mean in my life. Now, this is a table of spiritual principles that prepared before me in the presence of my enemies. Because my enemies are not out there or around that corner or over yonder. They're all right here inside. And this is not a secret weapon that I'm going to pull on them. It's prepared before me in the presence of my enemies. And these skirmishes I have with the other person, this is small arms fire, where the real big guns go off and where the napalm is dropped. That's the battle within. Anyway, these steps are also impersonal. And they're not just extended to a privileged few. If they work for me, they'll work for anybody. And I'm not what I ought to be. And I'm not what I'm going to be. But as a result of this program, I'm the best Buck Newsome I've ever had. And I can't measure myself against any other standard other than measuring myself against the way I used to be. And I'm happier, so this has to mean a little growth. Anyway, the first step, I think the Apostle Paul expressed this almost to perfection for me when he said, I do the things that I don't want to do, and I don't do the things that I know that I should do. In this respect, my life is unmanageable. Now, he didn't say it in that many words, but that's what he meant. The second step, the first three words of the second step, expressed in this manner, tells exactly what happened to us. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand it. These all important words, without which I do not think this program would ever have gotten off the ground. God, as I understand him, is not dumb. I don't have to give him instructions. I just try to report for duty. Not always successfully, but I try. And he's in the person seated next to you. And he's in the person seated next to them. And he didn't just sit up there and say, gee, I sure love you. He came down here and took on human form, his son. And they nailed him to a plank, the cross. And when he did that, he paid for every wrong thing you and I have ever done. And my answer is believing in him. And while he was hanging on that cross, he looked down at his tormentors. This is the ultimate of compassion. He looked down at his tormentors and asked that they be forgiven. If that had been me up around that cross with his powers, I'd have probably struck him dead. And when he was hanging there, he also said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? If he had reason to doubt, who am I? What is God's will for me? One thing I do know is for me to prepare myself to do his will. I like to tell this little story that helps to illustrate God's will. A little woodpecker was pecking away at a lone tree in a clearing once. A gathering thunderstorm sent a bolt of lightning, splitting the tree from top to bottom without harming the little fellow. And the birds came from miles around to ask him, how'd you do it? How'd you split the tree? When in reality, all he was doing was what he was supposed to be doing, where he was supposed to be doing it, and God did the rest. That's God's will for me, doing what I'm supposed to be doing, where I'm supposed to be doing it. And he will do the rest. I did make a searching and a fearless moral inventory myself first time in 1963. I did the best I could with what I had to work with at that time. I did a re-inventory in 1967. Now, pride says, with respect to this inventory, pride says, you need not pass this way. And fear says, you dare not look. And listen, Carl Sandburg has a little saying. He says, the graveyards of the nation are literally strewn with the burst bladders of the proud. Anyway, I did take a second inventory in 67, above and beyond the capabilities that I had in 63. And the purpose of this is to clean out the guts of your mind. Now, the way I took the fifth step is not the way to do it. But I'm going to tell you how I did it. I wasn't quite as bad as one of the fellows lives in Odessa there. First time he took the fifth step, he hired a wetback, Mexican, that couldn't speak a bit of English, paid him $2 and took the fifth step with him. Well, I wasn't quite that bad, but as a result of my attitude, which was lousy, I took the fifth step with a man in our group, and I didn't give a hoot whether he approved or disapproved of anything that I was telling him. And I didn't gain any release. There's nothing for me. There was nothing ventured, therefore, nothing gained. The second time I took the fifth step was after I'd done a re-inventory in 67, and I took it with my sponsor, Marceline, and I rationalized like this. Now that I've gotten this trash out of the way, I'm going to tell you about me. Well, this is phony. Because I was trying to maneuver, trying to guide, trying to control her love for me, which is for free. And love for free has no other desire but to fulfill itself, to love for free. Anyway, after that, I went into a long dry spell, the likes of which I hadn't experienced before. And it seemed as if my struggles to get out of this became a harness that bound me into it. And I was guided back to my sponsor. And in the process of talking to her, you know, good sponsors don't necessarily always tell you what you want to hear. They tell you what you need to hear. And she didn't fail me. She said, Buck, I think you were cheated on your first fifth step. I didn't like her for this. I went on back to Midland. This began to eat on me, and eat on me. Then in October 1968, the Fantastic, which is a conference in Lake Whitney, South Fort Worth, after this conference was over, practically over, I told Marceline, I said, I have to talk to you. And we went up in the treehouse, which is beautiful view, it's all screened in, you can look out across this lake. And there, in the serenity of this environment, I took the person that I loved and that I admired and I respect and I thought the most of, and I told her the worst of me. Now, ego cannot stand this environment. And when I got through, she threw her arms around my neck and kissed me. I said, Buck, I love you just the way you are. And then I experienced through this woman the forgiveness of God. She didn't have to forgive me because she'd never condemned me in the first place. I experienced the forgiveness of God. I had condemned myself. She told me, she said, I want you to go off by yourself. And I did, and for a while I experienced the release that I've heard people talk about after the fifth step. And I think this is when I really and truly joined the program. when I took it like it should have been taken. I experienced the release, the likes of which I'd never experienced before. It was kind of a state of euphoria. Total release from the bondage of self. Now this, too, came to pass. It lasted for a while, but it recurred. It reoccurred throughout a period of about a month. And I believe if I hadn't done this, that I couldn't have handled what was going to happen next in our lives. Because, see, that same month, our oldest boy, who was by this time a senior in TCU, called us one night, and he rolled out a bundle of dirty linen over the phone. And you know, Al-Anons and alcoholics are virtually shock-proof. And he told us some things that he had done, and Francis and I went into Fort Worth to talk to him. And we spent the biggest part of one night in a motel room sharing with our own son. We shared at a level with him that we had never shared between ourselves, because you see, we no longer mattered. This is our boy. And he was brutally frank about himself. He would say, "You remember when I said I got caught drinking a beer on the campus and was on disciplinary probation? That was a damn lie. I was drunk in a blackout when I came to. I was talking to a cop and I'd sideswiped three cars." He went the complete route. Drugs, amphetamines, he dropped acid, mescaline, you name it, he did it. I don't understand to this day how he maintained his fantastically high grades, but he did. We left the decision up to him at that particular time. He could either come home and go to AA, or he could continue on and try to graduate that year. He made the decision the next morning. He said, "I'd like to come home and just be your son for a while." You know, this gets pretty strong. And he did. He came home and he went to AA, and I wasn't there one night because it was a closed meeting. And Francis wasn't there. And he got up and made a talk. And he said, "Not because of my father and my mother, because of I know where they were, and I know where they are now, that my answer must be in Alcoholics Anonymous." I wish this story had a happy ending that I could tell you right now, but you see, he doesn't go to AA anymore. He's going to do it on his own. But we have released this boy with love. He knows he can come and talk to us and roll out anything he wants to in front of us, and we will not make him feel guilty, because if I ever make anybody feel guilty in my presence, I'm not loving him. I'm hating him. Back to the context of the story. I can assure you, if God is dead, he died since I took the fifth step, the way it was supposed to have been taken. The sixth and the seventh step never worked for me until I had the fourth and the fifth out of the way, like it should have been. One day, motivated by pain and guidance, each one of which by themselves don't seem to accomplish much. Pain, we've all been out there hurting, no guidance, didn't know what to do about it, and guidance without pain doesn't accomplish too much. Because nobody ever suffered from a lack of advice. I damn sure didn't. Anyway, I'm kind of tired and ready to have God remove all these defects of character, and I'm going to ask him to remove my shortcomings. Now, the way I used to read these two steps was, became entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character all at once. Didn't say that. But that's the way I read it. Became entirely ready. If I heard enough, then this particular recurrence of this old feeling, the likes of which I was familiar with, this happened. I knew what would happen if this was to continue. So that morning I became entirely ready to have God remove this defect of character, and I humbly asked him. Then I went on to the office. It was a particular busy day. Then, looking back on it and trying to describe what happened, this is the way it seemed that it was. That afternoon, I came to myself, and I scanned internally, and this old feeling was gone, and I couldn't believe it. And I thought to myself, God, I wasn't quite that ready. And then the next feeling that came over me was one of guilt. I'm supposed to be better than this. You know, I've been around this program for quite a while. You shouldn't be acting like this. And so I became, at that moment, I knew my answer. I became entirely ready to have God remove this defect of character, guilt, an insidious form of spiritual pride. And I humbly asked him, and it was gone, just like that. Now, for me, the sixth and the seventh step worked just like clockwork for a while. And now then, they don't seem to work too well. Now, if there be fault, it's mine. I'm not entirely ready to have God remove some of these defects of character that I still have. But I know that they work because I have experienced it. This knowledge of the truth, know the truth and it'll set you free. This old dog never would hunt for me. I have to experience the truth. That sets me free. Made a list of all persons that harmed me, became willing to make amends to them all. I did make this list, and when I made it, I found that high on this list were the names of some people who are already dead. And Chuck Chamberlain helped me here. He said, Buck, you made amends to the dead when you became willing. And this released me there. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I am trying to live an amended life as the result of this program. He used to have trouble with this. Somebody would say, has God forgiven you? I'd say, sure he has, but I can't forgive myself. Then, as long as I could cling to my guilt, I didn't have to act responsible. Then I was safe in this little cesspool I had dug for myself and filled with my own vomit. That's what self-judgment is. Though I heard somebody say, why don't you give it up and start living like a forgiven man and find out why you are alive. Boy, it's just like somebody knocking the handcuffs loose. And I sometimes feel guilty now about not feeling guilty. But I can handle that. And I no longer have any excuse for not acting like a forgiven man in the presence of forgiving people. And the only way I render myself unworthy is when I pretend to be something that I am not. At this point, after the ninth step, there are some promises in the big book. Bottom page 83 and top page 84 run something like this. This is not verbatim, but it says if we're painstaking about this phase of our development, we're going to be amazed before we're half through because we're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. And this has already happened. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. And this has already happened. We will comprehend serenity and we will know peace. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. No matter how far down the ladder we have gone, we'll see how our experience can benefit others. We will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. This is the most recent one that I have experienced. Fear of people and economic insecurity. Don't have any more money, just don't worry about it. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not, for they are being fulfilled among us sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly, but they will always materialize if we work for them. Here again, the basic principle. Output varies directly proportional to input. The tenth step, continue to take personal inventory. I am the district geologist for the Gulf Oil Corporation in Permian Basin of West Texas. I supervise the exploration activities of 18 exploration geologists and 5 geophysicists. I tell you this in order to make a point. Because the easiest way, this is just an example, the easiest way for me to stay out of trouble is if I'm wrong, to promptly admit it. And this is contagious. It catches on. These people catch on. And this makes for a much smoother operation. Don't get me wrong, I don't like to do this, but the step doesn't say you have to like it, it just says you have to do it. Seek through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand Him, praying only for knowledge of His will and power to carry it out. In 1967, June of 1967, I started going by the chapel in the church of my choice each morning on the way to work. And this continued for approximately 2 years. I'd like to say that it's going on right now, but this is an honest program, and I've dropped away from this. I hate to be late to let you in on that. But I'm going to try to get back to it. And there, in the silence of this little chapel, I seek through these two methods, prayer and meditation. Prayer, talking to God, meditation, listening. Praying only for knowledge of His will, for me, and the power to carry it out. The 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening is the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message. What message? The message of my own spiritual awakening. How did it come about? The result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and others and practice these principles in all of our affairs. I have had some luck 12-stepping alcoholics as well as Al-Anons. Along about the time the bottom dropped out at home, Francis went to the Big Spring State Hospital. You see, my sister reached her bottom too. And by this time, I knew what not to say. And I drove down to the ranch, which is 168 miles south where we live. And when I got there, her name is Jim, J-Y-M. She was sober. She was dry. She wasn't sober. And just as I started to go in, this prayer came to me. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in thy sight. And I went in, and we exchanged a few niceties. And then we sat down over a cup of coffee. I said, "Sis, I've got one question I've got to ask you." She said, "What's that?" I said, "First, I want to tell you that I love you." I said, "Do you want to stop drinking?" She said, "Yes, I do. I can't, and I'm scared." And she started crying, and then I started crying. And we just had a bawling good time. And I'm happy to say that there were some people in Midland who were willing to go down there to talk to her, share their experience, strength, and hope with her that she too might be privileged to enjoy this fellowship that you and I are privileged to enjoy right now. And her dry date is July the 26th of 62. She attended AA at Big Spring, at Midland, at Odessa, you know, all the surrounding area, San Angelo, and finally she got back going to AA on a local level. And she's real busy 12-stepping, and she's got a real fertile field. She lives in ranching country. In 1963, a man at the office who's an engineer was let go because of alcoholism. I called my wife's sponsor, Bob White, with the idea in mind of conning him into going over and talking to Archie. Well, this didn't work that way. Who ever heard of an Al-Anon conning a con artist? The next thing I knew, I was over there and fixing to knock on the door, and I was, "My God, what am I doing here?" And that was a reverent prayer. It wasn't profanity. And the same prayer came to me. Let that let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in thy sight. And I went in, and he had just been fired. We exchanged a few niceties, and I said, come on, Archie, I've got to ask you one question. He said, yes, what is it? Do you want to stop drinking? He said, yes, I do. There wasn't a meeting at our club that particular night, so we took him to a meeting in Odessa, and he identified on his first meeting, he heard Harold W. and Bob W. talk. And you know, I didn't carry the message to the alcoholic. I carried the alcoholic to the message. And about 2,000 years ago, this man carried a sick man to a meeting. And the Son of God, as I understand him, was there in person. And there was such a crowd, they couldn't get in. So they let him down through the roof. And he said, your faith, your belief in a power greater than yourself has made him whole. November the 11th, 63, and Archie hadn't had a drink since then. Now, I don't always meet with success, you know. One that is a pretty little gal, it used to be a PBX operator up at the office. She was married to an alcoholic. You know, God's got all the time in that there is, and I'm in a hurry. And I think that on this gal that I must have fancied myself as some sort of an illegitimate obstetrician. I'm in a hurry for people to get reborn, you know? And I think, I think I might have induced labor. And the results might just possibly have been a stillbirth. She's not drinking, she's not taking pills, but she ain't going to AA, and she's, well. Anyway, I've learned to leave well enough alone. Sometimes we're just supposed to sow the seed and leave it for someone else to reap when it's time. And you know, miracle of miracles, there are some alcoholics in our group that now claim me as their sponsor. Of course, they have alcoholic sponsors too. But my God, I wouldn't have given them the time of day 9 years ago. And don't you know, this makes me feel good inside. Because as a result, this program, somehow or other, this is the miracle. Somehow or other, all you people are shaped up. Of course, I know that it's me. It's changed just a little. I'm going to close now. I don't want to, but I'm going to. And I'd like to give you a little poem that expresses something about God as I understand him. And it starts off rather simple, and it ends up very beautifully. It says, I wish that I could understand the moving marvel of my hand. I watch my fingers turn and twist, the supple bending of my wrist, the dainty touch of fingertip and the steel intensity of grip. A tool of exquisite design, with pride I think it's mine, it's mine. Then there's a wonder of my eyes, where houses, hills, seas and skies in waves of light converge and pass and print themselves as on a glass. Line, form and color live within me. I am the beauty that I see. Then there's a wonder of my heart that plays so faithfully its part. I hear it running sound and sweet. It never seems to miss a beat. Between the cradle and the grave it never falters, staunch and brave. Alas, I have not the art to tell the wonders of my heart. But then there's a wondrous wonder of my brain, that marvelous machine that brings all consciousness and wonderings and lets me from myself leap out and watch my body walk about. It's hopeless. All my words are vain to tell the wonders of my brain. But do you think, O patient friends who hear these stanzas to the end, that I myself would glorify? You're just as marvelous as I. And all creation in our view is quite as marvelous as you. Then come, let us on the seashore stand and wonder at a grain of sand, or into the meadow pass and marvel in a blade of grass, or cast our visions high and far and thrill with wonder at a star, a host of stars, night's holy tent, huge and glittering with wonderment. If wonder be in great and small, then what of him who made it all? The eyes and brain and heart and limb, let's see the wondrous work of him. In house and hill, in sword and sea, in bird and beast, in flower and tree, in everything from sun to sod, the wonder and the awe of God. Ladies and gentlemen, when we came to A.A. Nalanon, I thought it was the end. You know it was. It was the end of the beginning. And I've stopped trying to grasp the message, whatever that is, and I'm concentrated more on sharing what little I've got. And in so doing, my own store has increased. So take what you can from any of these talks and sift it and fire it through the crucible of your own experience and give it away, and your own store will increase.